Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
We have another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast today. We are talking with Richard Feldman, who is a good gun guy. And talk a little bit about who you are and what you've done in the past and what you're doing now.
Sure. Greetings to everyone. When I got out of law school, I worked for a couple years in the Reagan administration. And then I went over to the National Rifle Association as the regional political director for the Northeast. Probably the event some people might remember, if they're old enough, was the Bernie Goetz incident, the subway gunman. Bernie was my baby at NRA. And later I went to run the Firearm Industries Trade Association in the 90s. In the last few months, I've tried to put together an organization called the Independent Firearm Owners Association. And we're taking a little different approach. We're very strongly in support of firearm civil rights, but we also are looking at the issue from a broader criminal justice perspective. And looking pretty intently at this issue, it's quite apparent that what propels so much violent crime in this country is control over the illegal market in drugs. And if you eliminate that problem, you eliminate a large part of the need that people feel for firearms for self-protection. So we're sort of combining these issues in under one banner.
You're getting a lot of press kind of being painted as the guns and weed gun group. How do you respond to that?
Well, you can paint it any way you like. I think it's a long past time in this country that we had a serious discussion with ourselves about this war on drugs, its cost, and its consequences to the country, to our economy, to the fabric of our nation, to our inner cities. These issues are interrelated. You want to highlight the issue and call it guns and weed, that's fine. But this is really a very serious discussion, and it's one this country hasn't had. Like so many things we seem to do, we sort of go at it because it sounds like the right thing at the moment without thinking about it carefully and judiciously. So it's way past that time, and hopefully we're going to add our voice to this issue.
Cool. Have you seen the movie that I made with Nima Vedati called Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom?
I saw the first half of it.
Yeah, I'll have to send it to you. That's somebody put me in touch with you because of that about a month ago when you were just getting this off ground. And someone sent a link to me today of, hey, Michael, you should check this out. It looks like your kind of thing. It's a gun rights organization that is not against legalizing marijuana. Personally, I don't take marijuana. I don't take any drugs. My daughter died of cancer and smoked marijuana to get some relief from the chemo the last year she was alive. And it just kind of made me into an activist thinking, you know, somebody could have thrown her in a cage for that. And it just made me insanely angry. I don't know if insanely is the word, but it made me very angry that somebody could throw her in a cage for something that was making her hell a little less hellish. So that's how I got involved in it. I definitely believe that the war on drugs fuels the war on guns. Could you do you agree with that, and could you extrapolate on that idea?
I think it's not without consequence that they both started at about the same time. The 68 Gun Control Act and Nixon's war on drugs really came at about the same moment. So much of the war on drugs was code for war on black people at the time. It's still apparent so much of the consequences are really in the minority communities. And we've never, you know, why is it that we have so much trouble in this nation learning from our own history? Forget about learning other people's history, just from our own history. Whatever one may consider about the prohibition of alcohol and the reasons that it went into effect right after World War I, clearly the consequences of that amendment to the Constitution led to far more difficulties and problems that we're still living with in many ways than the perceived problems with alcohol in the first place. And we certainly, we learned enough from that in about 10, 11 years to maybe a few years more to pass another amendment to the Constitution overturning the first one. Now, I don't know what else to say. You know, if we can't learn from our own history that when people are going to do something, they're going to do it. They're going to do it whether it's lawful or unlawful. And, you know, I've always, as a Republican, felt that the role of government is to protect you from me and me from you. It is not the role of government to protect me from me or you from you. We have a government in this nation now that is incapable of delivering on the services that we really require it to accomplish, and yet they're involving themselves in our lives where they're not needed, not wanted, beyond the scope envisioned by the creators of this nation. And as we think back in terms of liberty and freedom in this post 9/11 world of privacy rights and what it is that the government can know about us and control of our lives, I mean, we're either going to put a stop to it now or we are well down that slippery slope of no return. Once you lose your rights and your liberties, it's very difficult to gain them back.
You're a man after my own heart. We had a little audio problem, and I heard you pulling out duct tape. That's how I solve things.
The ubiquitous duct tape.
You also had to go feed the llamas, but you moved to New Hampshire. You have a bed and breakfast, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Where'd you move from, and how do you find it different from where you were?
Well, I lived in Atlanta for 13 years. And I'm now about an hour and a half from the airport in Boston and an hour from Manchester. And the difference is that what used to be a short hop, skip, and a jump anywhere in the country out of Atlanta is now an all-day affair getting anywhere.
Well, you know, they say when you die and go to heaven, you have to transfer through Atlanta.
Well, that's true if you live in the South. That's definitely a fact. In fact, I moved to Atlanta from Palm Beach because of the airport. I was traveling so much, I was spending my life changing planes.
I'm still getting a little bit of that bumping. If you want to lean back from the mic an inch or two, I think it'll help. I think it's now it's just plosives. You know.
Okay. Poof. It's on a nice cushion.
Yep. Sounds better.
Okay, good.
So talk about your new gun organization. What's it called and how's it different from other ones?
The Independent Firearm Owners Association. And we are on Facebook, as well as our website. You know, in many ways, I think we're somewhat traditional. Most of the positions we take, I think you'd expect a gun rights organization to be taking, but possibly not everyone. And I think that part of what's been missing in the debate is a little more nuance to some of these issues. You know, there's always multiple ways of getting to the same point. Sometimes they're smarter than other ways. Sometimes you can bring more people along. Other times you got to fight. You know, I remember as having been involved in the gun rights battle since the early 1980s, that back then, it was far from clear which side was going to prevail. As one looked around the world then or now, most countries don't allow their citizens to own guns, and it's gotten worse over the last 30 years. Australia, Great Britain, and other countries have made it more difficult. I think that the right to keep and bear arms is more than just another one of the amendments. It's very basic in its sense. And you know, before the Heller decision a few years ago in the Supreme Court, which ruled that you have a constitutional right, individual right, to own a handgun for self-defense at home, at least. We used to talk a lot about the issue, and you know, even if there wasn't a Second Amendment to the Constitution, I wouldn't have any difficulty arguing that you still have a right to own a gun. No one has ever said to me that you don't have a right to life and liberty. Let's leave aside the pursuit of happiness for a moment. And if you have the right to life and liberty, of what value is this fundamental human right if the government effectively denies you the very means to enforce that right? I often have talked to reporters in my job, and you know, frequently they didn't get it on guns. I'd say to them, look, you have a First Amendment right to publish and say what you know you want to say, and I can't prevent that a priori. I can sue you after the fact, but I can't stop you from printing it beforehand. But if I could put you in a prison cell and prevent you from filing your story, as you pass me a copy of the First Amendment to the Constitution through the bar cells and say, well, you can't do this to me, I'd say, that's nice. And I think then they sort of begin to understand if you can't enforce a right, that right does not really exist.
Well, I feel like lately, I mean, I've always felt that the government at various points, you know, federal government and some state governments and some local governments consider the Second Amendment an archaic loophole to be closed. And I've even heard it described as that by gun grabbers. I'm starting to feel like the government feels like the First Amendment is a loophole to be closed. Are you seeing that too?
Well, I think certainly when you get into some of the privacy aspects of the First and Fourth Amendment, when you start talking about freedom of speech on the internet, yes. What exactly are you referring to? Maybe I could be a little more specific.
Yeah, SOPA, PIPA, all these internet bills coming down. You know, and it's always guised under, we need to do this for security. You know, they're saying, well, terrorists could take control of the internet, but really it seems like what they, or, you know, people are pirating on the internet, but it seems like that's just a camel's nose under the tent or a Trojan horse to get in more control on the internet. I think that the internet is the one thing the government didn't count on, even though they invented it. They didn't count on it being a way for everyone to have a radio station in their living room, and I think they don't like it, and I think they're trying to rein it in.
Well, that's kind of the history of government. It's, well, you give them some power, and they try and exercise that power. One can look at, you know, whether it's the gun issue or drugs. The history of gun rights in America is the history of racism, sexism, and elitism. You know, people seem to forget that one of the first Supreme Court cases that talked about the Second Amendment was the Dred Scott decision, probably the worst decision the Supreme Court ever rendered. But then Chief Justice Taney said that he could tell, and this is in the majority opinion, that Dred Scott was not a person or a human being, because if he were, he could own guns under the Second Amendment, and he can't. So, therefore, he's not a human being. It's after the Civil War. The first gun laws were pretty much enacted in the old Confederacy and basically said, oh, you need, if you want to get a handgun, is a license from the sheriff. And if you were white, you got it. And if you were black, it was denied.
And the same thing happened with drug laws. You know, early marijuana prohibition was passed as something to rein in those crazy Negroes in their jazz music and keep them from looking at white women. That was actually things that were said in Congress. I mean,
you know, I always remember the first couple times I saw Reefer Madness in college, I always thought that it was a comedy movie and was made to be a comedy movie. It wasn't until a few years later that I realized and found out that it was actually serious. It's so comical at this time. But again, look at the timeline. Prohibition ends in the early 1930s. And what do all the revenuers over at what's now, interestingly, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, they were scared they'd be out of work. So Anslinger had to come up with some new dragon to slay. And what was the dragon? That evil weed, marijuana. It was something that smoked by the Mexicans. And as you say, the jazz musicians. It's funny, we don't seem to have a huge problem in this country. If somebody has a liquor store and someone else opens a liquor store up across the street, you don't generally hear about drive-bys and bombings of opponent liquor stores. You might try and put them out of business by lowering your prices, but the problem with the drug market is you can't call the police and say, this is my corner. You can't take another drug dealer to court and say, I have the rights to this corner. The only way you can settle disputes over illegal products is with violence and force. And it's not the drugs per se that cause the violence. It's control over the illegal black market in drugs that leads to so much violence. I was in New Orleans 2 weeks ago, and I was at dinner one night with one of the New Orleans police captains. And he said to me that 75% of their shootings in New Orleans are drug-related for control over the drug market or in conflicts over payment. That doesn't generally happen in liquor stores.
Are you for the legalization of all drugs or just marijuana?
Well, I think the thing that's on the table today is really the discussion on marijuana. But I'm very much taken with the group LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And I think that Neil Franklin and Jack Cole make some very salient points when they say that the more dangerous the drug, the more important it is to legalize it so that we can control it and regulate it.
LEAP is almost entirely retired law enforcement, correct?
As opposed to active?
Yeah.
It's open to everyone, but I think the full membership are people that were sworn officers or prosecutors. I was on the police force for a year before I went to law school, certainly you're correct that most of the active leadership are retired officers because it's kind of difficult. It shouldn't be, but
that's the point I'm getting at. It's hard to be active law enforcement and be pro-ending prohibition.
Well, I think that's beginning to change a little bit. But if you start looking at the industries that benefit from the war on drugs, obviously law enforcement and police unions, the more we have to fight it, the more money we have to get, the more the prison construction industry prospers. There's all sorts of players in this morass that prosper off of the war on drugs. The more prosecutors we need, the more judges we need. And for what? We've never sat down calmly, dispassionately as possible, and instead of looking at it as a moral issue, start to view this issue more like an economics issue. What are we spending? I mean, we're broke in this country. We're not a little broke. We're seriously broke. This is an auspicious time to reevaluate how we spend our precious resources, whether they're law enforcement resources, the taxes. I don't know very many people who think we don't pay enough in taxes. It's always somebody else that isn't paying their fair share. But anyway, you cut it. We've spent $1.5 trillion in the last 40 years on this war of drugs, on drugs. Are we any... Drugs are more available today than they were 40 years ago.
Do you think that...
And they're a lot cheaper.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
Do you think that Heller was a coup for gun owners? Because I know that some gun grabbers considered Heller a coup for them. I mean, they try to paint anything any way they can. But I'm thinking of the of some of the opinions, particularly Scalia, talking about that there is room for banning certain types of weapons while still voting in favor of the Heller decision. What do you think of that?
Well, Scalia's comment about that wasn't overturning all state gun laws, that's true. It said, you know, everything's always about balance. It's not all one way or all the other. It's about balance. So Heller said you have a right to own a firearm, a handgun, for self-protection. For all the years I was involved at NRA, that was the Holy Grail. We won the Holy Grail, so it has to be reasonable. It has to make sense. So you can't say, fine, you can own a gun in your home. You'll pay a $50,000 license fee and wait 30 years and we'll allow you to own a gun.
That's how it is in Ghana, in a country where most people make about $1,200 a year too.
Well, you know, in many ways, I think a lot of citizens in places like New York City, for example, there are 7 million people in New York City. If you have to pay a pretty hefty fee to apply for a license to own a handgun in New York City, it's not so hefty in the rest of New York State, because they do everything possible to prevent decent citizens from owning guns. I would like to see those things change. And that brings us back to the Independent Firearm Owners Association. We plan on concentrating our efforts not in the great places like Wyoming, where you are, where your gun laws are...
Where I can walk into a store and buy a battle rifle if I put the money on the table and walk out with it and load it in my car and have it sitting on my car seat legally. And if a cop pulls me over, there's nothing he can do about it.
and that would be, let's see, that would almost be the case here in New Hampshire. You could buy it, you could have it, but I guess you couldn't actually have it loaded on your seat. You'd be violating the fish and game ordinances in New Hampshire. But aside from that, the same would be true. But they put people through the ringer in states like Massachusetts and Rhode Island, Maryland, California. Interestingly,
are the states where you can smoke marijuana and it's like a traffic ticket, if that, and you can get a doctor's note and do it legally. That's the thing that I've always, I mean, a lot of my activism has been based on getting the gun people and the weed people to quit the fussing and the fight. And it actually goes back to something. Do you know the writer Robert Anton Wilson?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him.
Sci-fi guy. He wrote something in the 60s. He suggested something called the Guns and Dope Party. It was kind of a joke, but it was kind of making a valid point. He said basically if the gun owners and the dope smokers in California got together and started a political party, they'd have a majority, which made sense. And then he went on to say that half of Congress should be replaced by llamas, which is funny. And you're a llama owner, but don't know if that'd work. But
Our llama... Chauncey Lima Bean III would like to take this opportunity to announce his candidacy for the Congress of the United States.
There you go. I like it. I like it.
And just because he's a llama doesn't mean he's not entitled to have a say.
I think Wilson was saying that llamas could do as good of a job as most of Congress. But
what's changed? It's I think as Americans. We look at this idealized notion of Congress, and we're looking for leadership from them. We're looking in the wrong place. Congress isn't about leadership anymore. They're the biggest bunch of followers that ever existed. They're always taking polls. Look, if I'm running a political campaign, and I've run plenty of them, it's the nature of the beast. You want to know what the electorate is thinking. And sometimes you might want to get a little ahead of the curve, but you never want to get too far out front because you're always thinking about votes. So the issue isn't, I mean, there's a couple of different issues. You can talk about changing the system, or you can talk about winning. I'm more interested in winning than changing the system. Let's win first and then change the system second. That's a faster way to get where I want to go.
How do you suggest winning?
There's nothing mysterious about it. In a country such as ours, it's one-on-one. It's when one person starts to talk to one other person. I'm talking to you, you're talking to me. And we start feeling like, hey, there's a commonality here. We're in agreement. Maybe there are more people like us. And as you start to talk to people, and now with the internet, it's relatively easy to get feedback very quickly from people. And lo and behold, it turns out that there's an awful lot of people that feel just like us on these issues. But we've been kept separated. We've been kept fighting each other because it's been in the interests of lots of people to keep us separate and apart and at war with each other. And it's time to say, screw you. We're going to go forward and do what citizens in a democracy are meant to do and have the right to do. And it's change the way our leaders look at what leadership's about. They don't want to be left behind, but it's our job to show them that not only do we think from poll data that legalization is now around 50-50, but we've got to get that figure up and we've got to put some oomph behind that. We got to show people that this is an issue that can help them get elected and it could prevent them from getting elected. And once you get to that level in a movement, that's what gives you political muscle. It's what gives you power. And people start to pay attention because it can help them or hurt them. It's not that complicated.
I mean, Obama ran on decriminalizing marijuana. That was a stated platform of his. And then after he was elected, someone asked him about it at a town hall meeting, and he literally laughed at the guy. You know, Romney, there's video on YouTube of some guy with a debilitating disease in a wheelchair asking Romney, do you think I should be able to smoke marijuana? And Romney saying no. Both of them are gun grabbers. I can't believe the NRA backed Romney. Romney was in favor of the scary black rifle ban. I heard this saying one time, a guy named Jim Goad said, every election is just two millionaires arguing over who loves the common man more. It's really starting to feel like that. And then you've got someone like Ron Paul, who's been consistent for 30 years, who actually is offering people more freedom and less taxes, and everybody else, left and right, is offering them the opposite. You know, and I mean, there was stuff going on in Wyoming here where the GOP was squashing votes and doing things that, you know, at best violated the GOP bylaws and at worst were possibly electoral fraud. And they were doing it openly to get rid of the Ron Paul delegates. I mean, that's been happening all over the country. But I did an interview on here with a guy who was one of the delegates who has firsthand knowledge and is, you know, willing to sign a paper that says, yeah, this is what happened. It seems to me like personally working within the system is no longer valid. I'm personally putting all my energy into just educating people. Are you still working within the system and do you plan to?
I've worked within the system, and the beauty of it is that as people feel that their vote doesn't count and that they're just one person, that's what allows lobbyists and political operatives like myself to be greater, have greater power. The fact is that it's, you know, at the end of the day, money doesn't vote. Educated, informed, angry people vote. And there's nothing better than to get people mad. That's what motivates people. And when people are mad at what's going on and say, enough is enough, that's when they go to the polls, and that's when all of a sudden these incumbents find that they're no longer in the majority. You watch, it wouldn't take 24 hours for the Congress of the United States to be coming around and saying, well, you know, I've always felt that we were moving in this direction, and, you know, we have to reappraise that. There can be tremendous movement in this country, but it sometimes takes a tsunami to get people to wake up and face reality.
I feel like we're headed for the tsunami, but not there. Like, personally, I don't even vote anymore, but I'm still going to go down and vote for Ron Paul, just to make a point. I do vote. I do vote for him. Ron Paul's not going to win. It's either going to be Romney or Obama, and both of them are tyrants. Both of them want to take away your guns, your weed, your internet, and your money. What's the solution in a situation like that?
Well, you can't plan on starting at the top. It's all about, you know, Tip O'Neill said it best, all politics is basically local politics. And you start at the ground level up. Obviously, 100 people in a local council race or a selectman's race are a huge group in a small community. You start small. You start with state legislatures, with councilmen, with county officials. And, you know, the Congress, they're watching what's going on back home. And you start winning a couple of elections like that, you get your attention real fast. You're not going to get the presidential candidates. Actually, I'm amazed. We had two presidential candidates this year, initially as Republicans, also Gary Johnson. And Gary's now going to be the Libertarian Party candidate for president. And I just got an email today that former California judge Gray is going to be his vice presidential running mate. Judge Gray wrote a book on the legalization of marijuana.
I like Gary Johnson, but I think he made a mistake in running basically against Ron Paul, which is what I think he's doing.
Well, every Ron Paul supporter I ever ran into said, Gary Johnson's my second favorite choice.
Yeah, he is mine too. And, you know, I hope he can stick around and gain more traction in the coming years. He's young enough and he's energetic enough. And, you know, he'll do cool things that other people won't do, like show up at the New Hampshire Free State event. Are you still an active attorney?
Yeah, I'm active in D.C., although I live up here. I'm an active member of the bar. Although I have a case in New Orleans at the moment.
Federal?
Federal District Court of Eastern District of Louisiana against the Sheriff of St. Tammany Parish, which is across Lake Pontchartrain. I'm one of the attorneys, and one of our other board members, Danny Abel, is lead counsel from Metairie, just next to New Orleans, on that case. It involves a fascinating case. It's the first and only case I'm aware of alleging violations of the First and Second Amendment against our clients in that case. The sheriff arrested our client when he was maliciously fingered for something that he didn't do. They had a search warrant. They confiscated in his home search a shotgun that didn't belong to him. It belonged to his son, and all sorts of religious articles. He was released 2 or 3 days later. This is now over 3 years ago. He still has not had the religious items or the shotgun returned to him. So we have filed a complaint in federal district court, and you can read the complaint on our website.
What's your website? What's the URL?
It's ifoausa.org. Or you can just Google independent firearm owners. You'll get it.
I'll link that also in the Anarchy Gumbo blog post for this at kittyfeet.com if someone's listening on the radio. And for those who don't know about how attorneys work, and you have to be admitted to the bar of the state or District of Columbia that you're in for state or district things, but any attorney that's admitted to the bar in one state can fight a federal case anywhere. Just wanted to clarify.
Well, I was admitted pro hoc in this case.
For that
bond
case.
Motion.
Yeah. Just wanted to clarify that so you don't get all the Free State New Hampshire people calling you up to try to defend them in New Hampshire in state stuff, because I know they're doing a lot of activism there that involves getting arrested.
Well, I live just outside of Keene, New Hampshire.
That's where it's happening, Keene in Manchester.
Here in Cheshire County, and it's a great place to live. One of the reasons I think New Hampshire was spared the worst of the recession is because we are a freer state. There is less government control here in New Hampshire. It's palpable. I live just a few miles north of the Massachusetts border, and I guess I'm in a border town, and we don't even have to speak Spanish. But you can really feel the difference between the heavy hand of government between a state like New Hampshire and one like Vermont. The government is much more intrusive in Vermont in the lives of its citizens.
There's actually about a dozen libertarians in the state Congress there.
They're, at least.
Most of them are in as Republicans. I think one or two are in as Democrats because that's what they had to do in their area to do it.
And there's a lot more people that there's a tradition of libertarian thinking in this state. You know, our state motto, "Live Free or Die," comes from the Revolutionary War hero. General Stark, who, when asked to speak about 30 years after the Revolution. And he was ill, I think it was even in his deathbed, he said, "Men, live free or die, there are worse things than death."
I liked it. Bill Bryson, the travel writer, described New Hampshire as the only state that has a motto on their license plate that threatens you. But it's not a threat, it's a leave me alone kind of, it's a don't tread on me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's an orientation, it's symbolic. It's symbolic of the way this people in this state think, but it's not always translated into reality.
There's a very visible open carry movement among young people in Keene in Manchester. Do you know about that?
Oh, sure. I've got to be honest. I have some mixed feelings about it. As someone who has had a carry license, well, ever since I first moved to Florida back in 1987.
That was the first state other than Washington State that had that, right, that had shall issue?
You may be right about shall. It was the first of the modern states. In fact, it may have predated Washington.
I think it was Florida got a lot of press for it, but it turns out that Washington State actually had that in practice before that, but just no one noticed it. No one.
You may be correct, and you're certainly right that Florida got a lot of ink on it. The media was all saying, oh, there'll be blood running in the streets, and of course that didn't happen.
Well, the only unintended consequence, blood in the street, of that was that I remember soon after they did that, criminals started going after rental cars with rental car stickers because they could have a fair bet that those people were not packing, and rental car companies started taking the rental car company stickers off the cars as a response.
You are exactly correct about that. I was living in Florida at the time, and it's the one and only time in my life that I actually had a gun and had an altercation on I-95 with someone, pulled off to the side of the road. He pulled off to the side of the road, backed his car up to my car, got out of his car with a crowbar, started walking over to my car, and at that time, there was no stand your ground. That was the retreat rule. So you had an obligation in Florida then, as about half the states still do, to retreat.
Step back a few feet.
Well, I wasn't about to drive backwards on the shoulder of I-95. You know, the distinction between the stand your ground and the retreat rule jurisdiction it's great law school discussion, but for all intent and purpose, it's almost immaterial. By the time you realize you're in immediate danger, you have no escape route.
Yeah. The stand the ground thing goes back to like medieval sword fighting, I believe.
You know, it's kind of like live free or die. It's a statement more than it's some huge difference between the two that we're talking about. We love to talk about things that really don't have much meaning in this country. Instead of talking about the problems that has gotten us to this position, the war on drugs, people feeling the need to have community watch patrols, and why are people so frightened of a 20-year-old black kid in a hoodie? Well, because he looks like a gangbanger. Why are we scared of gangbangers? Because they're, or at least television tells us, and a good deal of it's true, is, you know, they're dealing drugs. And how do they enforce their control of the black market in drugs? With violence. So these are...
Yeah, I mean, I blame the state for everything. I blame the state for almost everything, and definitely for the violence of the war on drugs. I mean, it's really, you know, those guys would either be... If drugs were completely legal, those guys would either be rapping for a living, playing basketball for a living, you know, working at a store, or starve to death, you know, in a just society.
Well, what always sort of got me as a police officer was, you know, again, when I go back to this theme of balance and risk, who should society be more concerned about? Somebody who's shooting up drugs... is going to go rob a local bodega store to get the money. Nowadays, heroin is so cheap, you could panhandle enough for a score. Thanks to the war on drugs, incidentally, heroin is cheap.
Because of all our soldiers, over there guarding the poppy fields.
Well, that's right. And we have a CIA that from time to time seems to have been involved in the running of cocaine back to the United States to fund their own little wars in Nicaragua.
I don't break any laws at all, you know, I don't break any laws at all. I'm completely a law-abiding person, but I am literally more scared of a cop than I am of, you know, some dirtbag drug addict on the street. Because the dirtbag drug addict on the street can't hurt me in any way that I can't defend myself with a gun. A cop can. You know, cops often these days look for reasons to mess with people to, flex their power, get arrest, something. You know, they're largely, I feel, not...
But to show their usefulness.
They're not protecting.
Got to make a lot of arrests.
They're not protecting anymore.
You know, to show that they need more police.
I think
all the arrests we made.
I like that.
More money, we'll make more arrests.
I like that as a lifelong gun owner, you say you've had one occasion to pull your gun, and you did not shoot the guy, right? You pulled the gun and the problem went away, right?
As he got to the front of my car, I pulled my .38 revolver. I kind of leaned out the window. I pointed the gun at him. I said, "You got a problem, bud?" He dropped the tire iron, said, "Sorry, my mistake." Turned around, walked back to his car, got in his car, turned it on, and drove away. I got out of my car, and right now that tire iron is hanging in the garage about 30 feet. He wasn't injured. I wasn't injured. His car wasn't damaged. My car wasn't damaged. Having the gun, at a minimum, prevented my windshield or headlights from getting smashed.
And your skull at maximum.
But... You know, when you say, it's an interesting, words are so important in this discussion. When you say it's the only time you used your gun, I that's not true. Any time I have a gun on me or near me, that gun is in use. I've only had to pull it on someone once, but I use it whenever it's there. It makes me feel very comfortable because I know that I can take care of myself. And when I lived in Atlanta, I never left the house without it.
There's a tradition in karate of that ethical practitioners of the art, they don't go out looking for fights. They try to avoid fights. And it's often said by karate masters that a person who practices karate as a lifestyle at best, will probably maybe use karate to defend himself once in a lifetime. And I think that's about accurate stats for most gun owners, if that. You know, it's not the blood in the streets. It's the, you know, I have fire extinguishers in my house, but I'll probably never have a fire. But I might, and I'm glad I have fire extinguishers.
Well, that's a perfect example. When people say, well, Richie, why? I don't understand. Why do you carry a gun? What are you afraid of? I'm not afraid of anything because I carry a gun. For exactly the same. If you told me the one day in my life that I would need a gun, that's the only day I'd carry it. But since it's the same thing for a fire. If you told me
the one day in my life I was going to need a gun, I wouldn't bring a .38 though. I'd bring a rifle.
Well, again, it goes back to another question we started to talk about concealed carry and the great advantage that a handgun provides over a long gun is its concealability, so that your opponent is unaware that you have a gun. I rather have the element of surprise on my side. I don't wish to advertise the fact, and many states, open carry is lawful, but here in New Hampshire, it's lawful.
It's lawful in many states, but people get hassled by the police for it. I think there's two states where people don't get hassled for it, and it's Wyoming and Arizona. I've seen countless videos on YouTube of people lawfully carrying and getting hassled by the cops.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So about rifles, that's kind of the other holy grail of the NRA is hunting. It was interesting to me that the assault weapons ban, you know, this carry black rifle ban, went after things like AK-47s when really, I mean, you can't fight a real war with those. I mean, I think that the Scalia comments were basically saying you can have a handgun to protect against the mugger on the street, but we don't want you to have anything that would match what the government has. And people say you're a terrorist when you even talk about this, but do you agree that the founding fathers, the reason for the Second Amendment was to keep the government from getting too big?
I don't know about big, but intrusive. I remember back more in that direction. You know, as long as we have elections, we end up with the elected officials that we deserve. When people give up, they get crap. And when people get angry and get mad and get activated, they elect better people, people more representative. I recall very distinctly back in 1994 when the assault weapons ban passed, and so many people I knew, not crazy people, pretty responsible people, were saying, Richie, they were burying their guns in a pipe in the backyard, and they were saying, I remember so many people saying to me, you know, this is it. When are we going to the streets? And I'd look at them and I'd say, Roger, as soon as they cancel the next election, I will lead the charge, a lock and load. But until then, it's our responsibility in this system to convince our neighbors, our friends, our relatives that we're on the side of righteousness and that we need to get rid of this and the people that have given us this stupid, crazy law. And we did. That was the Republican Revolution of 94. Like so many revolutions before and since, they sort of didn't achieve in victory what they set out to achieve in the election. But that's another story for another day.
Well, I've also heard it said that when it's time to bury your guns, it's time to use them. And I don't think it's been time to bury guns yet. Mine are not buried. I just wonder when they're going to quit messing around with going after Glocks and semi-auto AK-47s and go after the bolt-action deer rifle. Because really, I think that is the most powerful weapon that a citizen can own, is a bolt-action deer rifle. You know, I'm not advocating anything, but if someone were to, and I don't think a revolution could be fought at this point, because I think
well,
the fact
I'll
ta- that they
I'll take
just...
a Chi-Tech over a bolt-action Actually, Shytec is bolt action.
Bolt action 308 is a sniper rifle. You know, it's the thing that works at 500 yards. The AK-47 isn't.
Work in a mile. There's a couple confirmed kills in a mile and a half.
Yeah, but
with the Barretts and the Shytec.
Yeah, but, the 50 cal. No, but you know, that's you can't carry it under your coat like you could with a deer rifle.
What gets missed in this debate, and once we start, sometimes you got to step back. When I love to debate as much as anybody, more than maybe anybody, but once you start getting into a debate over good guns and bad guns, it's really lost.
I'm not making the debate. I'm wondering. Okay, they're making the debate. I'm wondering when they're going to wake up. And
once you start down the path of, well, you know, a 10-round magazine is okay, but an 11-round is bad. I could have two 10-round magazines, one in the chamber in each hand. So now I have 22 rounds. How is that different from having, you know, it misses the point. And the point isn't that complicated. It's that we don't address the question. And the question is never about the gun. The question should always be, in whose hands are the guns?
What do you think are reasonable controls on gun ownership or who has gun ownership?
Well, I think in general, the fact that we ban the possession of firearms to convicted felons in general is okay. I think even that's kind of silly as a general rule, because what's a felony in Wyoming is a misdemeanor in Montana, vice versa.
There's a guy facing 10 years in prison for 2 ounces of pot in Wyoming.
Because he had a gun?
Nope. Because he had it bagged up in quarter-ounce bags. Actually, because he's a city council member and they're going after him because they don't like his politics.
Well, again, I mean, so, you know, I think we're a smart enough people to be able to differentiate between violent crimes. Best example I can give you is Patrick Purdy, the shooter from Stockton, California, that led to the Roberti Roos first assault weapons bill in California. Patrick Purdy had been arrested 22 times on violent felonies. So we can probably fairly well assume he probably committed several hundred if he was arrested 22 times for them. He successfully plea bargained all 22 felonies down to misdemeanors. The guns that he purchased to use in that shooting in Stockton, California in 1989, he purchased lawfully. He went through the dealer record of sale, the transfer, all the paperwork, the waiting period, got the guns lawfully, and then I forget how many kids were killed. And if I recall, he killed himself or was shot. I actually don't recall. How much brains does it take that somebody like him should have been able to lawfully buy a gun?
He shouldn't have been out. And which leads me to another one. I've heard a really interesting take on who should have guns and who shouldn't is if you're too violent to have a gun, you should still be in jail.
Run that by me again. If you're too violent,
to own a gun, you should still be in jail.
Well, I think I sense where you're coming from here. My point is just that, you know, we prevent violent convicted felons from lawfully owning guns. Doesn't prevent them from obtaining them. And one of the facts we don't really throw into the broad debate that the Independent Firearm Owners Association wants to always maintain is there are over 500,000 firearms stolen in this country every year. So if we can fix some problem over here or some problem over there, and if there's a problem, there's probably a solution. But we make a terrible mistake if we think that fixing this problem is going to have any impact whatsoever on criminals being able to obtain firearms. Not going to happen. But again, The problem has to be always addressed in whose hands are the guns. I have over 140 guns. Does if I bought 140, my 141st, is all of a sudden am I going to become go into the local bank and rob it? I have the capacity to do that now if I wanted to. I don't rob people. So the number of guns is irrelevant.
That's my problem with waiting periods also of I could almost make an argument for there should be a waiting period for your first gun, but I don't think there should be a waiting period for any guns after that.
I know exactly where you're coming from, and I think it's certainly after you own one, you know, what difference does it make? But we don't have waiting periods. Now, some states do, but under federal law, and most states don't. I mean, I can walk into a gun shop and buy every handgun they've got and take them all home with me if I've got the money for it.
They'd be happy to sell them to you.
They'd be happy
to sell them. They'd close for the day.
probably, maybe even the week, depending on what kind of supply they had.
So I want to talk about... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I want to talk about the trigger locks a little bit, because we weren't recording when we talked about that. It's not often that I talk to somebody who directly influenced something that physically exists in my house. In my house, in the basement, I have a bag of unused gun safety locks because all the guns I bought when I lived in California were legally required to have them. And even in Wyoming, pretty much most gun manufacturers and some stores put one on anyway to cover themselves legally or, you know, in the press if anything happens with the gun. You are the reason guns come with safety locks. Is that correct?
Well, I might not put it quite that way, but
it's your fault. It's your fault.
No, it was my solution.
Was that to keep Clinton from outlawing guns?
No. It had a lot less to do with Clinton, although we made the announcement in the Rose Garden with Bill Clinton.
So you've hung out with Bill Clinton?
Yeah, for about an hour.
did he smoke weed with you?
No, but I kind of wondered about that little stain on the floor in the Oval Office. that was right before the whole Monica Lewinsky affair. It was only about a month later that it surfaced. But at the time, and this goes back to 1997, a couple of companies were starting to put child safety locks on all their guns. But this was about liability for the gun manufacturers, the most typical lawsuit that any handgun company normally would receive is when somebody has their gun and, you know, a kid obtains it and, you know, was playing with it and ends up shooting themselves or a friend, and typically they'd sue the gun manufacturer. So, you know, after looking at the issue, you know, by providing a child safety lock, it avoided all these lawsuits. Because what are you going to say? You know, not only did the if I was defending the lawsuit, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, not only did the defendant manufacturer provide a device that worked exactly as they promised it would, unfortunately in this situation, but they also provided a device that would have prevented it from being misused had the owners, the plaintiffs, used the device we provided. So, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what would you have had the manufacturer do? Tuck every gun they ever made in at bed every night and make sure it's... I mean, so from... It was a business decision. People who think it has something to do with politics, well, I mean, it had something to do with politics.
So what did you do... to propagate that happening? Did you write legislation for the NRA that they presented, or what happened?
Oh, no, the NRA was rather furious with me, actually, at the time. They had come to us, and, you know, I represented the people who manufactured, distributed, and sold firearms and related products. NRA represents users of those products. This had nothing to do with use. And frankly, if the proposal had been that we would support any kind of mandatory use, I was then and am now dead set against it. What's appropriate in one household is totally inappropriate in a different household. You can't legislate, 200 million households in the country and how guns should be kept in them.
But some states do, though, right? Some states mandate those in the home.
Some states do a lot of stupid things.
I have one of those in my home. I don't have any kids, so I have one of those gun locks holding up my bird feeder to keep it from blowing away in the 60-mile-an-hour winds we get in Wyoming.
Great. Use it on a bicycle. Throw it away. Leave it in the gun
shop. They're too short for bicycles. They're good for gates. I've locked gates with them, too.
Great. But it protected the manufacturers from stupid lawsuits, expensive stupid lawsuits, I might add. And, of course, our legal system is rigged so that once you're named as a defendant in a lawsuit, you've lost. After you've spent $100,000 or $200,000 defending the suit, and the jury comes back and says, judgment for defendant. You go, great, now how do I get my $200,000 that I spent defending the lawsuit? But you don't. But if you're a plaintiff in the suit, of course, you don't spend any money, and it's the plaintiff's lawyer who ends up spending the money. And if they win, they get, generally speaking, a third of the settlement or the judgment.
Yep. My wife.
On the other hand, I mean, I'm an equal opportunity anti-lawyer. I have some nasty things to say about the defense bar. I call them the outhouse lawyers, as opposed to in-house counsel. Because when you work as general counsel for a company, you think like the company. If you're working as general counsel, say for Smith & Wesson or Ruger, it's in your interest if there are no pending lawsuits against your company. You have a fairly open calendar. But you're going to be paid the same amount of money whether you have no lawsuits pending or 200 lawsuits against you. You're going to be spread pretty thin with 200 lawsuits that you're going to have outside counsel. It's not necessarily in the interests of outside counsel to say, oh, let's be done with this. This is a stupid suit.
So how did you get gun manufacturers to start putting locks on every gun they sell? Was it a suggestion? Was it a mandate? How did it happen? And what was your part in it?
It was total. What happened after I had the meeting, actually, the meeting was with Rahm Emanuel, my director of government affairs, Bob Ricker, who's passed away now, and Jim Baker, who was then doing some representation for SAMI and the National Rifle Association. I believe he's now the director of federal affairs at NRA. And Rahm said to us that in a couple of weeks, the president was going to push this legislation. I forget who the senator was that was mandating the use of child safety, of trigger locks. And as your gun folks know, trigger locks are fine on certain guns when put on correctly, but they can be rather dangerous. If you put them on incorrectly in front of the trigger, you can fire the gun, and yet it has a trigger lock on it.
Yeah.
So, and you can't tell from looking at it whether it's on correctly or incorrectly. So they can be a little dangerous, and there are plenty of other locking devices. And, of course, trigger locks don't work at all on certain guns. Colt 1911, you can't put it behind the trigger because it's a solid trigger. The bicycle lock type, it keeps the cylinder from closing, and visibly you can see that a gun with a cylinder open is, for all intent and purpose, not a functional firearm. And if it has that same thing going down through the chamber and out the magazine well, you can be certain that that gun is not capable of firing anything at the moment. So there are multiplicity of ways of securing a gun, and I felt very strongly that the person best able to make the decision on what to put on their gun was not the Congress of the United States, lobbyists for gun rights organizations, but the manufacturers who manufacture the gun. They're the ones that had the lawsuits. They're the ones in the best position to decide, what do I want to put on this gun that's going to cover me from a liability perspective? it really wasn't about, I sometimes sort of hate to say it, but it wasn't about saving children's lives. I think that was a great additional advantage. No, undoubtedly, there are people who are alive today that might not have been or would have been injured because those locks get used in situations, you know, your typical situation, a woman, perhaps a single mom buying her first gun for $400, $500. She's not going to spend another $1,000 on a gun safe, but that locking device will prevent a six-year-old from being able to fire the gun. It's not going to prevent a 14-year-old from using a hacksaw and getting through it, but mom and dad are going to know that Junior broke the child lock and accessed the gun. That was always its intent. It wasn't to prevent someone from being able to use it, you know, and break through it, but more of a young child. That was its intent. That's what the lawsuits came from, and that's what it does. And so, it's kind of very non-controversial now, and I'm so glad that you're able to use that lock, courtesy of the handgun industry, to hang your birdcage.
Although I probably paid for it in the price of the gun. But
yeah, it probably, it may have added somewhere between 99 cents and $1.20 to the price of your gun. Yeah.
So when you were in the room with Rahm Emanuel, could you smell sulfur?
He's a bright guy. I don't think we agree on a whole lot of political things together. But the fact that we disagree on most things, or many things, was not going to prevent me from working with him on something that we did agree on, even if we agreed on it for different reasons. I wanted to prevent the Congress from mandating the gun industry to do something that wasn't going to work well. We were going to do it one way or another. I'd prefer to have done it on our own, without legislation, without regulation, and be in control of our own destiny that way.
Do you know his brother, Ari Emanuel?
I know who he is. I don't know him.
He's a Hollywood agent. There's actually a TV show I've been really enjoying called Entourage. It's kind of a sitcom about some young Hollywood rich guy movie stars. Their agent is this guy named Ari Gold, who's based on Ari Emanuel. And Ari Gold is a guy who would buy your company and burn it to the ground rather than have you do something he doesn't like.
You know, on one blog in the last couple of days, somebody wrote in, he expected this new organization to go out and endorse Obama. Or he said, I bet they'll endorse Obama. I immediately wrote back on the blog, I'll take that bet. when you go to our website, ifoausa.org, we have a mission statement. If we deviate from that, call us out. If we stick to us, then if you disbelieve us now, you're forgiven. I'm past the point of caring about what other people think, other than those, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're setting out to do. We want to join forces. This is primarily a gun rights organization, but not a drug policy organization. But the two are inextricably interlinked, and there are advantages for both groups in working together. And what we hope to accomplish in some of the bad states we talked about earlier is be able to bring some folks to the playing field that have never felt comfortable with a gun rights organization. And we want to be able to go everywhere as a gun rights organization and talk about the impact that the war on drugs has had on our level of violence and the need, or perceived need, people have to own guns and carry guns. And frankly, if there was no crime, I still like guns, I like shooting, but if there was no crime, I don't see any reason why I'd want to carry a gun. It's burdensome. I certainly respect the right.
If there was no crime, I would carry a gun because there are wild animals in Wyoming that can kill me.
I have one of those wild animals right now on my arm.
What is it?
His name is, what is your name? Oh, Stanley. He's half boxer and half American bulldog. He's a tiny little lap dog. He weighs about 90 pounds.
Awesome.
He's a big boy and so strong. I can't believe how strong. And he's clawing at me right now because I've been ignoring him while I'm doing this show. And he doesn't appreciate that.
Well, we're almost done. Were you friends with Ronald Reagan?
I'd like to be able to say I was friends with Ronald Reagan. That wouldn't be accurate.
Did you know him?
I did get to know Ronald Reagan a little bit. It was, I guess, 1991. I had just taken my position heading up Firearm Industries Association, and a friend of mine was a lobbyist in Sacramento that was ran the farm in Santa Barbara, and I had worked for him in the government. And I said, gee, Dennis, would you find out from the president, are there any guns he would like? It'd be great. We'd love to make a presentation. So he got back to me a week or so later. He said he'd like to have a single-action Colt revolver that he used in a lot of the Westerns. So I called up the president of Colt, who was on my board of directors, Ron Stillwell, and told him, and he was all excited. And I said to Ron at the time, in addition to doing this single-action Colt, I want to present Reagan with an AR-15. I have the pictures of it with him shooting that AR-15. He shot two rounds at the ranch, 223. It was heavily engraved. The serial number of the gun was RWR and his birth date. And on the revolver, it was his birth date and RWR. Both guns had the seal of the presidency on them. Rancho del Cielo is ranch.
I think that revolver is in Wyoming now in the Cody Gun Museum.
Really?
Yeah. They've got, I think so, or else either that or they have a gun from his Hollywood days. I know they have a Reagan revolver there. They also have the Colt, the gold inlaid Colt they gave Cheney. They have the gold inlaid something, I think it was 1911, that they gave JFK. It's quite an amazing museum. If you ever make it to Wyoming, the Colt Gun Museum. Unbelievable.
I look forward to coming to Wyoming.
Not the Colt, the Cody Gun Museum in Cody, yep. Wyoming. It's a great museum. It's got it's five museums in one. There's a firearms museum, a Western art museum, a natural history museum, a Native American museum, and cowboy museum. It's pretty amazing. I mean,
the AR-15 is at the Reagan library.
Yeah, I would think it would be. I know there's a Reagan gun there, but I'm thinking it might be something from when he was a TV cowboy, Hollywood cowboy.
I kind of suspect both those guns are out there
in California.
In California. Yep. Of course, that particular AR would be illegal for somebody to own now in California, which had something to do with the reason why I wanted to give it to Ronald Reagan. And I will say, this was only about 6 months before they announced his Alzheimer's. But I got to tell you, he had us in stitches. We were sitting around the veranda, President of Colt, myself, a couple guys from Guns and Ammo magazine. He was just regaling us with stories. And, after we were drinking Cokes and soda and after what seemed like probably an appropriate amount of time, it was my event. I stood up and, being the good advance man, I said, well, Mr. President, I know you have other things to do today and we really appreciate the opportunity to be out here. And he's kind of smirking at me while I'm saying this. And when I finish, he smiles and he says, sit down, Sonny. I'll let you know when I'm done with you. Everybody cracked up.
That's awesome.
And then he actually invited us in the house. It's a very tiny house, the ranch. And we had an interesting incident. The Secret Service was, of course, all out there, and they were cool as could be. No hookers. They were fine when we were with handling the guns. One other interesting note. We had a custom holster that Galco had made for them, and that for that single action. And naturally, a brand new custom holster is going to be very stiff. So when he put the gun in the holster, he couldn't pull it out. So he motions for me to help him. Well, I have a picture of it that the photographer from Guns and Ammo took. As I'm pulling the gun out of his, helping him pull it out of the holster, he has a kind of pained look on his face. And what was going through my mind was, I am surrounded by the Secret Service. I am the first person since John Hinckley to have a gun pointed at Ronald Reagan. Now, it was in the holster pointed down at his feet, and I know it was unloaded, but all guns are always loaded until I prove them otherwise, every time. It was kind of interesting. They were very cool about that, but when we went inside the ranch, Reagan showing us things, and he pulled a hatchet off the wall that an Indian tribe had given him. Two Secret Service agents jumped between him and us, and I go, he's the guy with the weapon. A little overtraining.
Hatchets there. Are always loaded.
Yep.
Well, cool.
Well, I hope this was the first of many opportunities we'll have to speak about this endeavor.
Anytime,
and
I
encourage your listeners to come take a look at us and get on our Facebook page, Independent Firearm Owners, and follow us for a while.
I appreciate
see
it, man.
What we're up to. I appreciate this opportunity.
Thanks, Richard. Keep fighting a good fight.
You betcha.
Right on.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadavi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiend show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.